This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the southwestern United States, we have set up detention facilities for those we have caught crossing our southern border illegally. President Obama ended those family facilities 5 years ago, but when the number of Central American refugees crossing the border increased dramatically last summer, the administration announced their return, and last month Congress allocated additional funding for them. In data obtained by the National Immigration Justice Center from 2008 to 2012, children under 18 spent a combined total of 36,598 days in 30 adult detention facilities, some spending as little as 3 days, others more than a year in custody. Some see this as illegal, others as an affront to our morals, and many deplore the conditions and the treatment these people receive at our hands. Last month, a law professor from Elon University and several of her students made the trip to the Carnes Detention Facility in Texas to provide legal advice to detainees. And today, some of them join us to talk about what they saw and experienced. Heather Scavone is director of the Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic and assistant professor of law at the Elon University School of Law. She's the one that took the trip. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Carissa Mendoza is a member of the class of 2016 at Elon Law. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Sharon Dunmore is a member of the class of 2017 there. Good morning to you.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone from Austin, Texas, is Edna Yang, the general counsel for the American Gateways Program, formerly the Political Asylum Project of Austin. There she directs the legal services for the agency representing indigent immigrants before the Immigration Service, the Immigration Court, and also in federal court. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about why you and six other students went to from Elon to Texas, let's talk about these detention centers. Why do we have them? I guess, Edna, we'll start with you because you've been working there in that situation for the longest time. Why do we have these places?
Well, I think the government stance is that we have these detention centers because if we don't, immigrants who are coming to the United States will just disappear into the United States. They won't come to their immigration hearings and we'll have a number of undocumented immigrants running around where we don't know where they are. The government used to have a program called Catch and Release where they would stop individuals at the border and place them in removal proceedings and then allow them to go to family members or to wherever they were traveling to and let them know they had to report for their immigration hearings. A lot of people didn't show up for those hearings, or that's what the government statistics were saying, that people weren't showing up consistently for these hearings. Part of the issue was that people didn't get proper notice or they didn't know that hearings were going on. There wasn't a lot of information given at the border at the time. So in order to ensure that people can actually show up for their hearings, we started detaining individuals. Even though they had no criminal history, even though they are fleeing violence, even though they were asylum seekers, the government made a policy decision that detaining individuals was the best way to ensure that they would appear in court and could present their claims.
So are these people in these detention centers people that we have actually caught in the act of crossing the border, or are these people that we've apprehended or detained because we stopped them for a traffic violation and we discovered that they were here without documentation?
So, Mike, it varies. In some cases, they're what we call arriving aliens, or they're individuals who did not enter the country illegally or attempt to, but who actually presented themselves at the border and requested the protection of asylum.
So there are people who cross the border because they're fearful for their lives, and when they cross the border, they go to our officials and say, I'm seeking asylum, here I am.
That's correct. And then there are also other people who are apprehended, as you were suggesting, who have entered the country without permission.
So are the So it makes sense to me that people who, I guess, if the argument is that they, if we just catch them and release them on their own recognizance and tell them, here's when you have to report to court, that many don't show up either because they don't understand or because they don't want to show up. I can understand why detention centers might be of some value. But for those that we apprehend or who are here with no reason for asylum, they just want to be here, why don't we just send them back? Or why don't we put them in jail until their court hearing?
Well, in practice, that is what's happening, because they're put into deportation proceedings, and so they're detained up until the time that they can have their individual hearing in immigration court to determine whether or not they should be deported, or in some cases.
Why do they get a hearing? If we catch them in the act of crossing the border, and they're not necessarily seeking asylum, Why do they get a hearing? Why don't we just put them on a bus and send them back?
Well, I think part of it, Mike, is because it's due process. Like, people might not actually be seeking asylum, but they may have other forms of relief. And the reality is that the vast majority of people who do cross the border are fleeing some sort of violence. And so saying that someone comes here because they don't want to be here and we should just send them across, back across on a bus, is really disingenuous, and it doesn't take into account why people flee their homes. People are fleeing their homes because there's violence, because they're being threatened and attacked. People don't want to leave their homes to go to a new place where they don't know the language, where they're unsure what's going to happen to them, just because I think that they're looking for better opportunities. They're looking for a place that's safe for their families and for their children, and giving them the opportunity to present their legal claim, which might not be apparent when they first cross the border within, you know, an hour or 30 minutes, is right, and it's what our legal system is based on, and that's what due process ensures for them.
Are these exigent circumstances that seem legitimate? You're fleeing for your life. You're fleeing because your child has been threatened by gangs, drug cartel gangs in Central America. These seem like and if you know if you go back, you're going to be killed. That seems to be a legitimate reason to seek asylum. That's an argument or a situation that seems to get lost in the dialogue, which is sometimes heated in this country, about what to do about these people. Do the people protesting understand that these things are why these people are coming here? And you're in Texas. You're closer to this than we are.
Right. So I'm not sure. I think people on some level understand, and I think that people do think that is a shame that these things are happening, but I think people may also assume that it's not a problem that the United States should take care of. But we have certain international obligations to protect individuals who are fleeing violence, who are actual refugees and who can prove that claim. And I think that it's our duty to give individuals the opportunity to present those claims, but to do it in a fair and just way. And family detention is not a fair and just way to allow individuals to have their claims and their hearings before an immigration judge. It's a very stressful situation, and it's not the best way to ensure that due process is preserved.
And interestingly, Mike, I mean, the question that you asked previously about, well, why does everyone automatically get an individualized hearing? In fact, part of our system is that you have to articulate, a credible fear in your home country before you're even entitled to that hearing before the immigration judge. And so, in many cases, there is expedited removal of people, and they don't get that individualized hearing.
When you went to Texas, you were at a family detention center, correct?
That's right.
And Heather, you say that the women and children who are detained in these facilities are civil detainees. They are not criminal defendants, nor have they been charged with any crime. So let's just talk about the adults. Let's not talk about the kids right now. If you enter the country illegally, aren't you guilty of committing a crime?
No, it's not a criminal. We don't have a federal criminal for an initial unlawful entry into the United States, so they're not being prosecuted. Now, they may not be allowed to stay, but also, you might remember I was mentioning some people, you know, present themselves at the border and essentially, you know, submit to the authorities and say, I require the protection of this country. They absolutely haven't even entered unlawfully.
So if a family shows up at the border, women and children, or women and men and children, or men and children, do they automatically get sent to the family detention centers? If you come as an adult, a single adult, or a man and a wife, do you get sent to a different kind of facility? What happens?
So go ahead, Edna.
Sorry. So the women and children go to the family detention centers, and men get routed to a separate detention center for men only. So we actually do represent individuals who are a complete family unit, but we're representing them when they're in different detention centers.
Now, your work as general counsel for American Gateways, Edna Yang, is to provide services to indigent immigrants. I would think many of these, if not most of these people, come across the border with little to nothing, so they're all indigent. Are these immigrants that you work with strictly people who have come here without documentation, or do you also work with people who have come here with documentation but who find themselves indigent?
So we do work with the vast majority of people who are detained are indigent, and we work with those individuals who don't have documents and are seeking asylum. We also provide services for individuals who are here in the United States and who are seeking assistance through family members or also seeking asylum because they came perhaps on a visa situation changed in their home country and they feel that they can't go back. So as long as people can prove that they are at or below 200% of poverty, we provide services to them.
And you work with four major detention centers in Central Texas, including the Carnes facility where Heather Scavone and her students worked with another organization, which we'll talk about. How many people do these detention centers house on a given day? How many flow in and flow out within a given day or month?
It depends really from day to day. I think it's best to think of it in terms of their maximum capacity because most of the facilities are kept fairly close to their maximum capacity. So Carnes
And what would that be, maximum capacity?
Right. So Carnes with the families has about 523 individuals. Dilley has currently about 500 individuals, although that's the other family detention center. And we've been told that that facility will soon be expanding to 1,200 beds, so it can hold 1,200 people. The South Texas Detention Complex for Men in Pearsall, Texas, houses about a maximum of 1,700 individuals. And then the Tidon Hutto facility, which houses single women, has a capacity of about 560 individuals.
Let me bring the youngest.
And they're kept pretty close to maximum.
Let me bring the youngest people in the room into this conversation for a second. Carissa Mendoza and Sharon Dunmore, who are two students who went to Texas with Heather Scavone and others to work in the Carnes facility. Before you went, what did you expect to see? What did you expect these places to be like?
Well, working for the immigration clinic that we have at Elon, I had a little bit of experience with working with refugees and asylees. So I had a little bit of insight as to their stories. So I knew it was going to be horror stories.
Let's talk about the physical nature of these centers. What did you expect them to look like, be like, feel like for these individuals who are detained there?
We knew that the detention centers will be in the middle of nowhere, that there's no signs of any sort of community around the area. So we knew that. However, I didn't expect the amount of apprehension that we received during our trip there.
Apprehension from?
From officers. The legal access to these women was very difficult. We had to go through some background check, which we expected.
And we're going to talk about that. I want to talk about the physical building. What did you expect when you got there, Sharon?
Frankly, I was expecting a prison. You know, we hear such negative things about these detention centers. I went in expecting the worst. I thought that there were going to be the barbed wires and we were going to walk in and have to go through security clearance after security clearance. Just bare walls. Wasn't really expecting much on the inside.
And that's not what you found?
We did, to an extent. The physical layout of Carnes, we did have to go through. It was very bare bones on the outside. When we got through the security gate, we went into the visitor center, and that was just very bare. They did have a little play area for kids, but it was very minimal. There was really nothing there for them.
Okay. In a nutshell, and I have 10 seconds, better or worse than you thought?
Same.
All right. We're going to talk more about the physical aspects of this and the people and the apprehension that you got from the guards, because this is, I think, an interesting dynamic here. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Discovery Place, presenting Illusion, Nothing is as it seems, now on exhibition. Mind-bending displays deceive the senses and demonstrate that perception is often very different from reality. Details at discoveryplace.org. And NC Green Power, connecting North Carolina K-12 students and teachers to greener energy through a solar PV grant program, ncgreenpower.org. Well, the latest reports say, are you ready for this? Charlotte is the state's leading tourist attraction. Yikes. Tourist destination cities have discovered that quality of life, transportation networks, and connections to various neighborhoods have to be in place to support a robust tourist economy. So how do we stack up with other tourist cities? We'll talk about that and more Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Fallout from the police shooting of an unarmed black man in South Carolina. The Boston Marathon bomber is convicted on old charges. And President Obama calls for an end to conversion therapies for gay youth.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the detention centers in the Southwest, particularly in Texas, where immigrants who come here without documentation are sometimes detained, particularly in these family detention centers where women and children are detained until their status can be determined by the federal government. Eddie Yang is the general counsel for American Gateways that actually is funded through the U.S. Department of Justice to help provide detainees with legal orientation. Heather Scavone is an assistant professor of law and director of the Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic at Elon University School of Law. She and six of her students went to the Carnes detention facility to provide some legal assistance to these detainees. And Carissa Mendoza and Sharon Dunmore are two of those six students who went there. Edna, the president, and I guess also Heather, because you obviously know about this. The president ended these family detention centers in 2009. Did he end all of them or merely the family detention centers, and why? And if he ended them, why are they now back and being funded?
So he did not end civil immigration detention across the board, just ended the detention of families. And family detention just is centers where women who enter with children are held.
And in that period where those centers were closed, what happened to those people?
So they're released on their own recognizance. They have a lot of incentive to appear for their immigration court proceedings because they can't, you know, be granted relief such as asylum unless they appear before the judge and make their case.
What if they just disappear into the vast stretches of the middle of the country? They're here.
And some people do that. Some people never show up to their hearings. But statistically, you're much more likely to go to your hearing if you are represented, if you have an attorney. And so that's one way that we could increase people's attendance at their court hearing.
And Edna Yang, the government says that in if we didn't have these centers, they would in fact probably not show up for their hearings for one reason or another. In the period where the president closed these family centers, was that the case? Did more show up or not?
Well, I'm not sure what the actual statistics are, but I agree with Heather. People have an incentive to show up to their hearings. I mean, they understand that this is their opportunity to present their claim for asylum, and they don't want to miss that. And so when people are released, they understand, and if they're given the information, and especially if they're represented, they know when they need to appear for a hearing, and they know what they need to do in order to complete that hearing. So people just don't disappear into the vast landscape of the United States, and that's that. I mean, I'm sure there are some people, but the vast majority of people who have claims want to proceed forward on those claims. I don't think that people enjoy being undocumented in the United States. I don't think it's a very easy life, and I think if they have a framework where they are able to present a claim and get some sort of legal status, people will move forward with it.
Of course, there is the risk that they won't be granted legal status, and if they are not granted legal status, what happens to them then? Do we immediately send them back?
No, people have an opportunity to appeal the decision of an immigration judge, and so they can file an appeal with the Board of Immigration Appeals and then present their claims again to say why they think that the immigration judge made a decision in error. It's just like any other legal system where people have basic rights to have decisions reviewed, to present evidence, to challenge evidence presented by the government. And those are kind of the basic fundamentals of due process. And so they're not picked up immediately. They may be asked to report, or they may be asked to report their change of address so the government knows where they are. But people will generally follow through with their claims and their procedures if they have the information and they know that it's their opportunity to remain here.
We have had conversations on this program with people who are here with documentation on visas that are about to expire, and the visas were granted because they brought something to this country, a skill to this country that we have trouble finding. And even though their visa is ending, they want to renew it, and it takes years for this to go on. How long does this process for an undocumented immigrant who's in a family detention center, how long does it take usually for the final decision to be handed down?
I mean, it can take a decade or more.
So would they be in these detention centers for 10 years?
No, they shouldn't be there for more than 6 months, but in practice, a lot of times they're held beyond that six-month time frame. In fact, we met in Carnes with a woman who had been there with her 7-year-old child for 8 months.
Mm. The immigration clinic at the University of Texas School of Law filed a class action lawsuit. It's referred to as RILR. I looked and looked and could not find any documentation on what those initials stand for, but it challenges the Obama administration's policy of detaining mothers and children fleeing violence in Central America. They got an injunction. Was that what closed these law centers initially, or is this after they've reopened?
That is subsequent to them reopening. So, in fact, the injunction was just granted February 20th, and it essentially said that, you know, the civil detention of these mothers and children who have asylum claims cannot be used simply for the purpose of deterring others from coming into the U.S.
So, in other words, you can't just say, look at what's happening to these people. We have to set an example for people who might come here under those circumstances. They have to have a legitimate concern about detaining these people.
Exactly. So that the practice of detaining them just for the purpose of making, you know, the symbolic detention, making an example out of them to show them that if you come here to seek asylum, which is you're allowed to do under our domestic laws and under international law, that will make it so painful that others don't want to follow in your footsteps. That has been enjoined. However, because of the government's recently published enforcement priorities for immigration, they're able to, so far we haven't seen in practice that they've been releasing these individuals. They're holding them on other grounds, calling them national security threats, et cetera.
RILR, does anybody know what those initials stand for, or is it even important? No one knows. Okay. you say, Heather, that your trip to Texas into the Carnes Family Detention Center is proof of noncompliance of these centers with that court order that we just talked about. How are they getting away with not complying with the court order?
Well, what they're doing is effectively saying, we'll release you, but placing very high bonds on the women and their children. And in some cases, they'll put a higher bond on a mother and not on their child.
Who's making that decision?
It's either the ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or the immigration judge in immigration
court. So the federal immigration system is going against the federal court decision?
Yes. shockingly.
Does that happen often, or is that like an internal struggle within the government on several issues, not just this one, or is this an extraordinary case where this is happening and it really doesn't happen anywhere else? Does anybody know the answer to that question?
I don't. I mean, in this context, and Edna, you might know more recently, I think I saw on the Carnes pro bono listserv yesterday that there was a bond as low as $1,500 in one case that had been determined, but frequently they're happening at $7,500. And so that's effectively like telling a woman you can't leave.
But my question is this an extraordinary situation where one part of the government is ignoring another part of the government, a federal court? Does that only happen in this case, or does it happen in a lot of different situations, not just immigration situations?
Oh, I wish it were an extraordinary occurrence, okay. But I have to imagine that it happens in lots of other contexts.
Okay. These detention facilities are not run by the federal government, nor by the states, nor by the cities or counties in which they are located. They are operated by private companies. Who pays these private companies to operate these detention facilities? Edna.
Well, we do.
The taxpayers? Okay.
Yes.
And why do we do that? Why don't we run them ourselves? We run jails. Why doesn't the government run these places themselves?
Well, we don't. The government doesn't run all Bureau of Prisons jails either. I mean, the companies that contract, there are three major ones: the Corrections Corporation of America, the GEO Group, and then the other one, which is MTC, and I can't remember what it stands for. But the CCA and the GEO Group are the ones that run the detention facilities, but they also run federal prisons. You know, they lobby for these contracts, they get them, and they say that they can detain civil immigrants, civil detainees. They can do civil detention just as well as they can do prisons. And so we, the taxpayers, pay these companies through the government and their contracts to have them run these facilities.
So what kinds of places are these family? I really want to know what they look like, what they feel like. Are they more like jails? Are they more like rec centers? Are the people who are there to guard these people, are they more like prison guards or are they more like social workers? What's it like?
Yeah, so Mike, I mean, what we saw visually, it doesn't present this spectacularly depraved space. I mean, the environment is like sparse but clean. There's a security gate that you, when you go through, it looks much like a security gate that you would see in a courthouse or something. And so visually, it doesn't look particularly terrible. It's cinder block. There's, there is barbed wire around the outside. When you get into the attorney.
To what end? Is that to keep people out or to keep people in?
I would assume both.
Okay.
In the attorney visitation area, there's a prison-style bathroom. It has no lock. It has like a brushed stainless steel mirror. So if you're kind of using your senses to describe it visually, I would say that's not the sense that makes it feel like such a nasty space. What it is the dynamics of control over the activities and the access to the women. And so guards, which are like prison guards, determine apparently arbitrarily how to enforce rules and what rules exist on a given day.
Do they carry weapons?
Edna, do you know? I didn't notice if they had guns. I should have looked.
No, the guards don't carry weapons. The ICE officers, some of them do, but the guards aren't given weapons, no.
Okay. Where did you get the idea, Heather, to go to Texas with six students and go to one of these detention facilities? Where did that idea come from?
So it was, without a doubt, the students' idea. They were very energized about this issue, and they essentially persuaded me to come with them to do this trip. I guess I should say, just for background, we have a really unique clinic at Elon because we're already a high-volume clinic. So we provide legal services to people with refugee and asylum-based claims, about 300 a year, which is very high volume for a legal clinic. And that's just because we really value the experiential learning and the social benefit that comes out of that program. So because we focus on refugee and asylum immigration cases, we were equipped to take on some of the issues in the cases of the detainees in Carnes. And so, based on a combination of us having the capacity and the skills to do that and the students' energy and enthusiasm, we decided to go.
Did you choose to go to Carnes, or did they, once they found out that you wanted to come there and provide legal advice, tell you where you would go?
We decided to go to Carnes because at the time that we were planning the trip, Carnes already existed. Dilley didn't even have residents yet. Dilley was like, the walls being put up and beds hadn't been filled with bodies yet.
So talk about the conditions. It's Spartan. It's prison-like in that they have removed mirrors and breakable objects so that I guess you can't start a fight with a broken mirror, or you can't commit suicide with a broken mirror. It's Spartan-like for that reason. Is it sanitary? Did you find that it was sanitary?
I mean, with the looks of it, it was clean. So it did seem like it was sanitary, and there were children that were sick, and there was hand sanitizers that were provided and tissues and whatnot. So in terms of that, it seemed like it was sanitary.
Did they have – these kids and the women there also have adequate access to medical care?
We had a good example with one of the detainees about the typical type of lament about medical care that happens. One of our clients that we worked with had seen a doctor, had been diagnosed with asthma, but was not permitted to have an albuterol inhaler. She explained that she'd been
told... That's a little bottle that you squeeze.
That's right.
Okay.
And so she had been told that in the event of an acute asthma attack, she should solicit medical personnel to get a nebulizer treatment. She indicated to us...
A nebulizer treatment would be a medically administered treatment that's far more expensive.
Absolutely. An albuterol inhaler costs about $15 and will last you 6 months to, you know, a year. A nebulizing treatment is about $500 and has to be administered by a physician. So it wasn't clear why she had been denied this, and we said, well, let's at least try to get her an additional audience with the medical provider so that we can correct this this problem. And so we, you know, with her permission and at her bidding, drafted a request that she just be evaluated by the physician to see if albuterol was appropriate. And we were told that that she couldn't have an audience with the physician and that albuterol was, quote, against their policy, which I have...
What does that mean?
I have no clue what that means.
Edna, has that been your experience? Is this a new story to you, or do you see this happening all the time?
No, we see that actually happening all the time. I wish it was a new story, but it's not. There's not a lot of explanation given for some of the decisions that are being made. I mean, detainees get medical care, but some of it doesn't make sense, just like what Heather was explaining. And when you ask for an explanation or a review, you're just told that's the decision.
And that explanation is coming from the owner-operators of these family detention centers, which in this case is a company called GEO. Why are they not bound? They're paid for by the taxpayers' money. You people are coming in there under the auspices of the Justice Department. Why are they not obligated to explain their policies to you?
I think it's kind of just representative of the conflict of interest that exists when you subcontract out to private companies the prison facilities and detention facilities like this one. It creates a conflict of interest. Who knows if the reason for rejecting the albuterol and insisting on the nebulizer was a legitimate medical one, or was because they get to bill more for the physician who's on payroll of GEO Group if they do that more expensive treatment.
So you mentioned, Carissa, that you found kind of apprehension mm-hmm. on the part of the employees of these detention centers over your presence there.
Yes.
Now here you are, young students, and these grizzled employees are apprehensive about your being there. Why?
So one day when we were there for approximately 11 hours with no food, no water.
We're going to talk about that.
And part of it is because they have a system. However, it's not being followed where we were supposed to see our clients when, you know, for that day. They're supposed to be able to leave, eat lunch, come back, or eat dinner and come back. However, that wasn't the case. The guards were telling us that, you know, if we don't meet with our clients at that moment, we can't see them again for that day. And given that we were only there for a few days, we wanted to make use of our time to the best of our ability.
I think you used a different word, Heather, when it comes to apprehensiveness on the part of the employees. You called it obstruction.
Yes, my vocabulary sounds
unapologetic obstruction is what you called it.
Yeah, I agree. I think Carissa's use of apprehension for vocabulary is because there's this tangible sense that the guards don't want the attorneys there. There's this open hostility that you feel when you walk into the building. And so who knows if they're apprehensive of us because they know that we can help the women access, their rights better and be able to actually make their claims. But yes, obstructionism, I'd love to talk about that.
And we will definitely talk about that when we come back. And I want to know if it's a different vibe than you would have gotten in a prison where an attorney comes in to see a client. We're coming right back with Heather Scavone, Edna Yang, Carissa Mendoza, and Sharon Dunmore in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the City of Rock Hill, presenting Kansas June 12th at the Old Town Amphitheater, Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tickets at get.crowntickets.com, South Carolina, just right. And Paragon Bank, offering a private banking experience to individuals, families, and businesses. Details about the client experience available at paragonbank.com/client stories. Well, it's Friday. That means it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the national hour first, then the international hour at 11. And in that first hour, fallout from the police shooting of an unarmed black man in South Carolina, Boston Marathon bomber trial moving to the death penalty phase, and President Obama calling for an end to conversion therapies for gay youth among the topics they'll be talking about. And we'll be back to talk more about immigration in just a moment. Stay with us.
If you're an actor, how much should you be getting paid? Well, that's hard to say.
And it involved a lot of variables, but principally it is, how much of a draw would that actor or actress be for your target audience?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, actors and pay equity, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration detention centers, particularly located in the southwestern part of the United States, and particularly in Texas, in this instance, the Carnes facility, where Heather Scavone and a group of six students from Elon University Law School went to provide legal aid. Heather Scavone is with us, along with Carissa Mendoza and Sharon Dunmore, two of the students who went. And Edna Yang joins us by phone from Austin, Texas, where she is the General Counsel of American Gateways. That's one of the organizations that provides legal aid to these folks. And you went under the auspices, I believe, of it, a company called RAICES, R-I-I-C-E-S, the Refugee and Immigration Center for Education and Legal Services, Heather. You say that GEO, the company that runs the Carnes Family Detention Center, imposes rules, different rules, on different days, which substantially change your access to these detainees. And you've described that as nothing short of obstructionism, unapologetic obstructionism. Why do they change the rules arbitrarily and capriciously? Or do they have rules for Monday and rules for Tuesday? Or do they just change them because you put in a request and they don't feel like honoring it?
Right. That's a great question, Mike. And I mean, I think, and I'll elaborate on specifically what things were done to obstruct our access, but all of the different tactics used in terms of changing the rules from day to day reflected the single theme that they were going to deprive the detainees of access to their attorneys and ultimately then deprive them of due process. And so the way that they would effectuate this is through changing rules that would prevent us from spending time with our clients. You know, we've traveled from North Carolina. We have specific advocacy goals when we meet with the clients. We can't bring a printer into the facility.
Why not?
Well, that's one of GEO's rules. We'll have, you know, have to ask them about that. But the types of rules that they would change from day to day just reflected that they have power over us and our ability to meet with our clients. For example,
does this come from individual guards or does this come from the person who's in charge of operating the facility?
It appears to come from the individual guard. So depending which guard is on duty.
So it's power.
Yes, yes. It's like just a mini dictatorship. Mm-hmm. You know, on one day you're allowed to bring food or bottled water in. Another day you're not. On one day, as Carissa started to explain, you're not allowed to leave the facility to go to your car to eat food in your car. If you leave the facility, they won't let you back in. In many cases, one particularly nasty instance of obstructionism that we observed involved a client of ours who needed to use the restroom. And she was told that she couldn't use the restroom in the visitation area, despite the fact that detainees and attorneys had been using it all day. It's not a really glamorous restroom. It's not mm-hmm. clear why. And so she had to be escorted from the visitation room, check out, go back to the residential facility, use the restroom there, come back to the visitation area, check in, be readmitted.
And all of this and that process would take how long?
I mean, you know, that maybe took 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes.
And did they do that so that 20-minute chunk no longer belongs to you and the client?
Precisely. I think there were really two reasons. One was what you just described, that we were then – that was 20 minutes less that we had to work with uh-huh. our client. And the other was essentially to demonstrate to the client that she doesn't get to choose when and where to use the restroom.
Sharon, you wanted to talk about this too.
Absolutely. Something that personally struck out to me was the fact that depending on who the guard was – on duty, when we would arrive in the morning, we would sometimes be able to bring in interpreting devices. Now, these women don't speak English. We need to have effective means to interpret and translate things.
And not all of them speak Spanish.
Not all of them speak Spanish. A lot of them come from native villages, so they speak indigenous languages. There's a service that we can access called the Language Line, and they actually will provide interpreters that we can use over the phone. There were many times where we were refused access to our cell phones. So that would limit us incredibly. We went with a small group, so not everyone in the group could understand Spanish. We were actually working with two students that could effectively interpret. So that limited the amount of clients that we could reach out to. It also limited the work that we were able to complete just because we had to move at a slower pace.
Edna, you're in Texas, and you deal with this every day. It was this treatment because here are a bunch of rubes from North Carolina trying to come to Texas to try to be helpful, in quotation marks. Or is this something that happens to all of the people who go there, including your organization based in Texas on a daily basis?
Right. I think it actually does happen to pretty much everyone who goes there for the first time. I think that Heather is right. It's an issue of power, but also there's this confusion that occurs because it's a private company that runs the facility. So there are family detention standards, federal standards that dictate access to your attorney and how a facility should be run for the care of the individuals. But those aren't codified, so they're not actually enforceable. And those are ICE's standards. So ICE has these standards of how families should be detained, even though they're not enforceable. And then it gives the process of running the detention centers over to these private companies, and then you have a huge disconnect. So when
if the rules that are in place and have been put in place by these private detention centers are at odds with due process under the United States Constitution, who wins?
I mean, I don't really think anyone wins.
But I mean, why wouldn't the Constitution prevail? You folks are legal experts. Why wouldn't you be able to say, look here, the Constitution says this and you will do it?
I think it's because the government, responds to litigation, and so it's going to require a lawsuit before that can happen. But then I think that would be the result. If you're asking yourself, why do they bother obstructing? Why do they care so much? Why are they?
That's why do they care? I was going to ask that next.
I think it's because of the inherent conflict of interest of outsourcing detention of people to these for-profit companies. So for them, they have a vested interest in a body in every bed every night. Attorneys accessing the clients, representing the women, increases their chance of being bonded out of the facility. And so, for the for-profit company, they're looking at you, attorney, as the person who can, decrease their profit margin by getting people out of the facility. That, to me, seems just at odds with the whole process.
What do they get paid to hold? I'm sorry, go ahead, Edna, go ahead.
And the only thing I would add on to that, Heather, it's actually interesting also because when you talk to ICE about it, they say, well, we don't want prolonged detention. We don't want people to stay longer than necessary. We want them to move through the process, either get their hearing or get sent back. And so that's that conflict of interest that exists again there, because you talk to ICE and they say one thing and then the private company has a whole nother goal.
What do they get paid to house the average person or the average family? Because women and children obviously have different costs involved, I guess.
So we heard at Carnes, and Edna, maybe you can verify this, it's about $430 per person per night is the cost to the taxpayer.
You could put them in a Holiday Inn cheaper than that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not a particularly intuitive way to...
Well, if there's a profit motive, and obviously there has to be because these companies are running these things not for their own edification but for profit, and you say they want to keep the beds full because that increases their profit margin, I would think they would also be on the other side of that, a desire to keep costs down. So how does that manifest itself?
That is one of the chief complaints that we heard from our clients was, for example, access to bottled water, which maybe that sounds frivolous, but it's not. If you look at the geographical positioning of this facility, it's about 200 yards away from a fracking industry, hydraulic fracturing. You're in the heart of like Texas fracking and oil facilities, and so the water is not potable in the facility, and so they need bottled water to drink. And you're absolutely right. Every time a decision is made about what type of food to feed the detainees, how much bottled water to give them, the profit considerations are there. And our clients complained that there was not enough bottled water, that they were not given enough milk for their children.
Were you and your students, and Edna, are you and your staff people given free run of these facilities when you go in, or are you limited to a certain area of the facility?
We are limited to just the attorney visitation room, which is a small space that has kind of subspaces where you can talk to a client confidentially.
So the conversations are confidential.
Well, we asked ourselves that because there's a little sign on the visitation room that says that we're not being recorded. Uh-huh. And so that's what it said on the sign.
Okay. You wanted to jump in here as well about what you here's the question. If you can't go in, if people from the outside can't go into the whole facility, how do we know what they're really like?
We really have to listen to the residents, the detainees, and get their stories, get their perspectives on their living conditions. Something that I personally did, I spoke to a lot of the children when we were there, and I just wanted to see how they liked the facilities. And I kind of got a take of their nutritional balance, the types of food that they get, their day-to-day life. So while their mothers were being interviewed and having intakes performed, I would talk to the kids and just see, oh, do you like the food that you eat here? Or
so this is anecdotal, but I want to hear it.
Yeah.
What did they tell you?
So I spoke to a bunch of children ranging from the ages of 4 to 13. And a lot of the issues that I came across, a lot of the kids said that there was limited access to milk. There was limited access to juice. They would put out maybe about a dozen cartons, and if you didn't get it, you didn't get it. I asked them, oh, what did your food look like? What does your plate usually look like during lunch and dinner? And they would say it was a lot of potatoes. There was like some watery meat. It didn't seem that they had access to a lot of vegetables or fruit during the day. And they just, a lot of the kids said that they didn't like the food. It made them sick. It hurt their stomachs. They had diarrhea. They had frequent issues going to the bathroom and things because they can't keep the food down because it's not enough. A lot of the complaints from the little kids.
Did you see the food?
I didn't, but
who prepares the food? Do they bring it in or they have an on-site kitchen with?
I think they have an on-site chow hall where they just go and.
So, Edna, you work in several of these facilities. Is it like prison food? Is it worse than prison food? Are there no standards for the kinds of food that they are supposed to serve these people? Do we have no conscience here?
Right. So, there's supposed to be standards. I've actually never seen the food before, but I've heard from clients as well the same kinds of complaints about food and food quality. And so they have kitchens, cafeterias on site there. And the interesting thing is that the women who are detained or the men who are detained at facilities, they can actually sign up to get quote-unquote jobs in the kitchen. And so they'll get paid. I don't think they get paid very much at all, probably like only a few dollars. And they can work as cooks in the kitchen. And so they can do that work to kind of supplement whatever detainee fund that they have to spend for phone cards and things like that. So it's another cost-saving measure. But we've heard consistent complaints about food.
Is it three meals a day? Is it three meals a day plus snacks? Are there things to do? Is there television? Are there books? Are there games? Are there electronic devices? Is there a playground area for these kids? Are there opportunities to exercise? Do they go to school?
Yes. The kids do get to go to school. I spoke to an 11-year-old girl, and she really enjoyed the art classes that they offered there. Huh. It seems as if the classes are being taught primarily in English, so that's something that they are now being able to access. They're learning the English language. Right outside of the visitation room, we can see through a window, and there was a soccer field and kind of like a little recreational area out there that people would congregate during the day. So,
what about the adults? What about the women who are detained there with their kids? Are they given what they need to take care of their children? Are they given opportunities for themselves to have a break, for themselves to educate themselves or exercise or have a decent time?
So I think a description of the physical aspect of the facility, again, doesn't sound shockingly terrible. There's this courtyard, the women, adults have access to it. It's more in the culture of how life occurs within the four walls. For example, that the women complained that sirens and flashing lights would go off intermittently, even while they were sleeping, that this was terrifying to the children. Their rooms look like kind of a dormitory.
Why would they go off? What would be the purpose of a siren and flashing lights?
I would love to know. This would happen intermittently, and it happened once while we were there. Uh-huh. So a loud siren and then these flashing lights, it's not clear. You know why that would happen.
So what is their prevailing attitude? Would you describe them as upbeat? Are they depressed? Are they – how would you describe it?
So from our interaction with our clients, they definitely seem depressed because first, they're thinking about all the situations that they went through back in their home country. But now they're depressed because they're thinking about how are they going to get out of this detention center? How are they going to get legal service? Because for many of them, they do not have access to counsel. So they're worried about their children because their children are losing weight because of, you know, improper
nutrition. But if you go to an immigration court or you go through the process of the system that we've set up to deal with it, are you not provided counsel?
No. Because it's a civil matter, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel has not been construed to apply. And so you can be a 7-year-old child in deportation proceedings to be deported back to a country where you may be harmed or killed, and you're not entitled to an attorney.
So there's no guardian ad litem program for these kids?
Not an immigration court.
Jeez. What do you think would surprise the average American most? What surprised you the most about all of this?
What surprised me the most was the treatment the women were receiving, the lack of medical care, the lack of child care, and the lack of proper nutrition was what surprised me the most.
If these were American citizens in these centers, of course they wouldn't be there if they were American citizens, but if they were, would their treatment be substantially different? Or does anybody really know the answer to that question?
Well, I mean, I think there are arguments that sometimes, you know, criminal detainees are treated better than some of these civil detainees, and many of which, you know, are U.S. citizens. But I think you're right. We don't know the answer to that question.
The government and everybody I've ever talked to on this program, peripherally connected to the immigration system, acknowledges that the system is completely broken. And yet the country that expanded across the country, across the continent, that won World War II, that became the world's only superpower, that sent men to the moon, cannot seem to fix this problem. In one word, do you see a solution?
We need to follow the rule of law. We need to enforce our own immigration laws and allow these women the chance to present their refugee claims in court.
Heather Scavone, Carissa Mendoza, Sharon Dunmore, Edna Yang. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte.